From your world news headquarters on the World Wide Web, it's time for your daily dose of sanity. This is the Maria Heller Show. Maria Heller is a published author, founder of the Universal Wheel, a lifestyle and philosophy based on our interconnectedness to all living things, a Reiki master, and delivers the news with spiritual views. How many intuitive news decoders, animal rights activists, and vegetarian broadcasters are there? Just one. Maria. Maria has provided independent news for a smart audience for over 13 years now on the Maria Heller Show, available at maria.net.
M-E-R-I-A.net.
And now, here is your host, the mouth that roars, Maria Heller.
Good morning, world. Maria here, alive and kicking. Today I have an excellent guest. I'm very honored to have him on my show. His name is Roger Stone. He's a legendary American political consultant, a strategist who played a key role in elections of Republican presidents, Nixon, Ronald Reagan, George Herbert Walker Bush. He is also the author of one of the most amazing composites of JFK information that I've ever seen, and that's what we're going to talk about today. The Man Who Killed Kennedy, The Case Against LBJ. So I'm very happy to have Roger with me. Good morning, Roger.
Good morning. I'm delighted to be with you.
It's my pleasure. You know, reading through your book, I saw so many names of people I've already interviewed, books I've already read on the JFK assassination. So I was pretty happy reading through the book. And also finding a lot of other information that was not covered in anybody else's books. And that's always what I look for. I mean, it has been 50 years. I've read quite a few books. What made you decide to put this book together?
I've been interested in this subject literally since 1954, when I was a preteen in the Goldwater campaign. I read a book called A Texan Looks at Lyndon, by J. Evetts Haley. It was a paperback. It was one of the earliest, I would say, dissections of the criminal activity and completely unscrupulous and dishonest nature of Lyndon Baines Johnson. And it really outlined very early a trail of murder that seemed to follow him around. Murder to cover up electoral fraud, murder to cover up epic corruption. I mean, corruption of biblical proportions. It really painted a photo of a man who was evil, just intensely and intrinsically evil. And I never really thought that the Warren Commission conclusions added up. There were just so many contradictions and a lack of motive on a number of the people involved in the official version of what happened I began to research. I would say there's 30 years of research in this book.
Oh, and it looks it.
10 years of writing, meaning I would write for a while, then I would have to run off on a campaign, so I'd put it aside, and then I would come back when the campaign was over, and I had free time to work on it some more. So it's been a labor of love over a long period of time. I knew it would be controversial. I knew that some in the mainstream media would seek to ignore it rather than just deal with its conclusions. But I've been very gratified by the response. I'm not unhappy with the overall press coverage. I must tell you, I'm very disappointed in CNN. I thought they were journalists over there. They booked me for Crossfire. They also booked me for Aaron Burnett. And then under pressure from the LBJ Library, they canceled.
Wow, I'm not surprised.
I thought mass media was about the exchange of ideas. And I was, you don't have to believe my book. It's up to you. Read it. See what you think. It's heavily annotated. It's heavily footnoted. I think my assertions are pretty heavily documented. But censorship, that's un-American. That's very un-American. That's almost like Soviet style. Very disappointing.
Well, I understand. You know, years ago, I had this gentleman on my show who wrote a fabulous book, putting together all the best quotes of Thomas Jefferson in different topics. And it was interesting because at the end of the interview, he said to me, which, you know, is still one of the greatest compliments I've ever gotten. He said, Maria, if Thomas Jefferson was alive today, he'd be doing exactly what you're doing. And, you know, when you look at the media today, you know, you have to say it's not really much different than during the Kennedy assassination, all the lies and cover-up. They're supposed to be, you know, telling us what's really going on. But all they seem to do, and I'm sure you noticed it all week, is reinforcing the official story, which I fully expected on this anniversary.
Well, it's a mixture, actually. They reinforce the official story, which at this point, in all honesty, I don't see how anyone with any objectivity or any intelligence could believe the Warren Commission. It's that bad. But then also they do give substantial coverage to ridiculous theories. JFK was killed by Jackie using a derringer.
Yeah, that is crazy. JFK
was killed by a Secret Service man whose gun went off accidentally. JFK was killed by Martians. I mean, just ridiculous stuff. That does get mass media coverage because it's a way to denigrate and dilute legitimate criticism of the Warren Commission. In other words, I'm not a conspiracy guy. Really not. I don't believe flying saucers landed in Roswell, New Mexico. I don't believe that America attacked itself on 9/11. I just don't believe those things. But this, I don't think Lyndon Johnson was the linchpin of a conspiracy to kill John Kennedy. I know he was the linchpin of a plot to kill JFK.
Oh, well, then, you know, listen, we're all entitled to believe what we want. And I think that a lot of times what they do is try to discredit the alternative media, anybody that ever questions an official story about anything. Now, reading your book, you know, you have information in there that I hadn't seen before. And I mean, I've interviewed everybody from Jim DiEugenio to Douglas to Fetzer. I mean, you name it, they've been here. Of course, except for Vince Bugliosi and his crazy book on JFK.
I was at Barnes & Noble in Dallas a couple of days ago and had a little spare time because I was early, so I took Bugliosi's book and I moved it from history over to the fiction section.
That's a good idea. That's a very good idea. Now, in your book, you talk about, let me tell you this first of all, your publicist, probably by mistake, had sent me two copies of your book. I had just finished reading Jesse Ventura's book on They Killed Our President, and I had passed it along to one of my good friends. When I got two copies of your book, I gave him a copy of your book, and he had just finished Jesse's book, and he says, I don't think I can handle any more JFK stuff. And I said, well, I'm going to leave it here, and you decide if you want to read it or not. Well, needless to say, he was as stunned as I am because he couldn't put the book down. I always knew, and maybe more so even intuitively, that Johnson was probably, you know, one of the dirtiest, disgusting human beings that ever walked the face of the earth. And that's putting it mildly, considering I'm from Brooklyn and I could use a whole lot of other words. But reading your book, I have to tell you, those first few chapters, Roger, I literally wanted to throw up.
Yeah, he was a coarse, crude, loudmouth bully. He enjoyed humiliating the people that worked for him. He was petty. He was vindictive. He was vicious. He was ruthless. He was just extraordinarily corrupt. I mean, there's no legislation, no major defense contract in the 1950s and 60s that got passed by the U.S. Senate without a payoff to Lyndon Johnson. This is a man who fathered three illegitimate children, at least two while he was president of the United States, with women in the secretarial pool at the White House. This is a man who used to conduct White House staff meetings while sitting on the toilet defecating.
I mean, what a pig. I mean, I got to tell you, I wanted to throw up.
The key thing to understand is he didn't do that because he was crude. He did that because he enjoyed the humiliation and embarrassment that it caused the people who worked for him.
Right. It's like a real true sociopath.
This guy is a manic depressive. Lyndon Johnson goes from these deep, deep depressions to these wild fits of temper. And I tie him to a trail of at least eight murders in Texas prior to JFK. Murders to cover up corruption. Mm-hmm. Murders to cover up the theft of the 1940 election, 48 election, which brought him the national power to begin with. An election which he stole by 86 votes.
Right.
Something I've never seen in American politics in my entire life. And I've worked on eight national presidential campaigns. I worked for three U.S. presidents and a number of presidential candidates. But I've never seen 200 voters march into a poll in alphabetical order with the same handwriting and the same ink and sign in. I've never seen that.
Right, or dead people voting. But, you know, people think stealing elections is something new, you know, because of the computer machines. But they don't understand this has been going on forever, and Johnson was king of it.
Well, particularly in Texas. I would argue that in 1960, the Nixon Lodge ticket carried Texas. They threw out 90,000 Republican ballots in Dallas County alone, and JFK and LBJ only carried the state by 50,000 votes. It was rampant voter theft in that election, too. And, of course, the tipping of one state or two, because I think Illinois was also stolen, mm-hmm. would have given the election to Nixon, and we wouldn't even be having this conversation. No, you're absolutely right. Voter theft is an old American tradition, unfortunately.
Sad.
And it seems to be centered around the big city machines.
Right. Well, you know, you did.
The little old lady Republican school teachers out in the suburbs are not adept at vote stealing. They're just not.
Right. Exactly. You say in your book pretty much that you were very close, or your political career was very connected to Richard Nixon.
Yes, he gave me my start. For those who may believe before they read it that this is some kind of partisan text and that, well, Stone doesn't like JFK and LBJ because they're Democrats. I'm pretty rough on everybody here.
Yes, you are.
I'm very, very rough on Gerald Ford.
Mm-hmm.
Very tough in the book on George H.W. Bush, who I worked for. Very, very tough on Arlen Specter, who was a good friend of mine, who I argued with over martinis on more than one occasion about the cockamamie single bullet theory.
Right.
I'm very tough on a number of Republicans, and I make no apologies for Nixon. He was both very great and very flawed.
Right, but I also feel like
he made enormous mistakes. But when it came to lying and corruption, mm-hmm. Lyndon Johnson makes Richard Nixon look like Rebecca of Sunnybrook Farm.
Please, Johnson makes Al Capone look mild. Back to Nixon. Wasn't Nixon convinced that LBJ was involved in the Kennedy assassination, and didn't that have what to do with what happened at Watergate to bury Nixon?
Yes, I think so. I think that it's kind of interesting because on November 22nd, 1963, there were four men who would become president all in Dallas that day.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of an interesting factoid, but you obviously had Kennedy, Johnson, Nixon, and George H.W. Bush all in Dallas that day. Nixon was there on legal business. He was representing the Pepsi-Cola company, and he was in town for a Pepsi-Cola bottlers convention where he was a speaker. He had a press conference on the 21st, in which he hit Kennedy pretty hard on foreign policy, and he interestingly predicted that LBJ would be dumped from the ticket, which is very central to this entire narrative.
Mm-hmm.
Was leaving Dallas at the time that JFK was landing in Dallas. By the time he gets to New York, he gets into a cab and he hears that the president has been shot. By the time he gets to his apartment on Fifth Avenue, he learns that the president is dead. He immediately calls J. Edgar Hoover and he says, "Edgar, was it one of those right-wing nuts?" "No," Hoover says, "it was a communist."
Mm.
37 minutes. They've only apprehended Oswald 37 minutes previously.
Right, and they already know
he's a communist.
Mm-hmm.
So Nixon believed that for about 48 hours. Then when he was watching television, along with millions of other Americans, he saw Jack Ruby blow Oswald away on national TV. And according to Nick Ruby, who was his aide, who was with him at the time, he jumps out of the seat, he turns white as a ghost, he points to the screen, he says, "I know that guy." Fast forward to 1985, when I have an opportunity to interview a pretty lubricated Richard Nixon, who had had a couple cocktails, which is the only time he got retrospective or introspective. Otherwise, he was a very buttoned-down guy who had very little interest in talking about the past and a lot of interest in talking about the future.
Mm-hmm.
And I asked him point blank, and he said, "Well, that's the thing about Lyndon and I. We both wanted to be president, but I wasn't going to kill for it." He further says, "That's the hell of it. I knew this Jack Ruby fella, went by the name of Rubenstein," mm-hmm. "an informant, Murray Schottner," that's an aide to Nixon, brought him to me in 47, told me he was one of Johnson's boys, asked me to put him on the payroll as a courtesy to Congressman Johnson, and we did. So I think once Nixon recognizes that Ruby is within Johnson's orbit, I think all the pieces come together. So fast forward. I believe the entire time Nixon was president, and we know this from the historical record, he tried multiple times to get his hands on the CIA records pertaining to the Kennedy assassination mm-hmm. and the Bay of Pigs, and he was denied, repeatedly denied. I believe that had he gone to trial in the Watergate matter, he would have brought down the whole house of cards, particularly the role of Gerald Ford. Gerald Ford specifically altered the autopsy records in his own hand to accommodate the government's single bullet theory. He moved the description of a wound in the upper left back of JFK that was 3 inches from the third thoracic vertebrae, according to the death certificate and the autopsy signed by Admiral George Bunkley, mm-hmm. JFK's personal physician. He changed that description to the lower neck to accommodate the wound on the front of Kennedy's neck, which the government claims is an exit wound. And, of course, the doctors at Parkland Hospital said was an entry wound, at least 3 of them.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm convinced that Nixon was pardoned because he would have brought down the whole house of cards. He certainly would have brought down Gerald Ford. He would have brought down the CIA. I think he would have brought the whole cover-up crashing down. There's no other logical explanation for the pardon because
right.
it cost Ford re-election.
Right.
It was certainly not in Ford's interest.
Now, did you say that Ford was one of the four future presidents in Dallas?
No, he would be the fifth president connected to the Kennedy assassination. He was not one of the four on the ground, but he was appointed to the Warren Commission by LBJ.
Okay, well, I missed one of the four. You said Johnson, of course.
It would be Kennedy, four presidents, Kennedy, Johnson, Nixon, and Bush.
Okay.
Bush.
Okay, I just wanted to clarify that in my own head.
Yeah.
You talk about, well, there's so much in here that I want to discuss with you. The gunman on the sixth floor. Okay. You really do a great job of connecting Lyndon Johnson to pretty much everybody that was a player in Dallas that day. He knew the people that owned the book depository. He was in tight with the cops. And you talk about a man named Malcolm Mac Wallace, whose fingerprints were on a box on the sixth floor of the book depository.
Yes, I think that the actual shooter from the sixth floor of the Texas School Book Depository is Mac Wallace. Mac Wallace is Lyndon Johnson's personal hitman. I say that because he is connected to a series of murders in Texas beginning in 1951. In 1951, a man named John Douglas Kinzer is intimately involved with Johnson's sister, who is a flamboyant, bisexual, bohemian party girl and sometime call girl who works at Miss Hattie's in Austin. She was an embarrassment to Johnson, but she had worked in the 1948 election, which he stole, and she had intimate knowledge of how it was stolen. Kinzer was blackmailing Johnson, trying to put the bite on him for money, and he wouldn't stop. So Wallace, who was working at the U.S. Agriculture Department in a patronage job at the time, arranged for him by Lyndon Johnson, went to a golf course in Austin and shot and killed Kinzer in broad daylight in front of witnesses.
Mm-hmm.
Fled. When he was arrested by the Austin police, according to the arresting officer, he said, quote, "You can't arrest me. I have to get back to Washington. I work for Senator Johnson."
Mm-hmm.
He was arrested. He was charged with first-degree murder. He was bailed out by two of Johnson's largest financial supporters. He was defended at trial by John Kofer, who was Lyndon Johnson's personal attorney. And he was convicted of first-degree murder, whereupon the judge, a Johnson crony, gave him a 5-year suspended sentence.
Right.
Now, I checked. He went to trial in 1952. Every person convicted of first-degree murder in Texas in 1952 went to the electric chair, except for Malcolm Wallace. Wallace is then immediately hired, I mean within days, by a company called Temco. Temco's now was subsumed by LTV, became a giant defense contractor. At that time was just a large defense contractor. TEMCO is owned by H.D. Byrd. H.D. Byrd is a right-wing Dallas oil man who owns the Texas School Book Depository Building. So I believe that Wallace is the actual shooter. Why do I think that? Well, he leaves a perfect 34-point match fingerprint in the on a cardboard box in the sniper's nest in the Texas School Depository Building. But additionally, as many as six witnesses say that they see multiple men in the windows of the Texas School Book Depository Building on the sixth floor just prior to the assassination. One man, Richard Carr, tells the Dallas Police Department that he not only saw a man meeting Wallace's description, meaning heavy set, balding, horn-rimmed glasses, in the window, but he also sees the same man, same brown jacket, same white shirt, fleeing the Texas School Book Depository Building only minutes after the shooting.
Mm-hmm.
There are no less than four attempts on Richard Carr, the witness's life, between 1963 and 1978. So once he files a complaint with the Dallas Police Department, he's never interviewed by the Warren Commission, but somebody keeps trying to kill him.
Right.
They try to shoot him in Texas. He moves to Montana. They try to shoot him there. He moves back to Texas. Somebody tries to shoot him there. And then when he's scheduled to testify for the House Select Committee on Assassinations, 1978, two men try to shoot him in Washington, D.C. So you have eyewitnesses who saw Johnson's hitman there. You have a fingerprint. That description does not match, 130-pound mm-hmm. Lee Harvey Oswald.
Right. And, I'm not a big – right. I'm not a big gun aficionado, Roger, but your book seems to make it clear that the rifle they tried to say that Oswald used, that Italian, I don't know, Mannlicher or whatever, it's hard for me to remember that, but you say it was a different gun.
Yeah, we know that there's a Mauser, which is a very fine made German rifle, is found on the sixth floor, on the fifth floor, hidden. And three Dallas police officers testify to that.
Mm-hmm.
And then two of them, under intense pressure, recant, say, oh, no, I was mistaken. It wasn't a Mauser. It was the Italian carbine, which, by the way, according to the government, Oswald paid $14 for. That's the quality of the rifle.
All right.
The third officer who saw the Mauser refuses to recant. He has murdered. They call it suicide, but there's no evidence that it was suicide. I believe when he refused to change his testimony, he was killed. So my speculation is that Mac Wallace used a higher quality German rifle to do the actual shooting.
Right. But you're also not saying that that was, the only shot.
I don't think he's the only shooter. I do think, along with many other researchers, that there's a shooter on the grassy knoll. I think there's likely a shooter in the Dow Tex building, which is right next door to the Texas School Book Depository building. I think that there may be a shooter in the sewer grate. I think there's multiple shooters, which of course means conspiracy. I also think it is virtually indisputable at this point that President Kennedy was shot from the front and the back. And the government was doing enormous gyrations to try to cover that up, manipulate the autopsy.
Right.
The Warren Commission was never shown x-rays or photographs of the autopsy of the wounds. They were given hand-drawn artist's renderings.
How ridiculous is that?
If that doesn't scream cover-up, I don't know what does.
Well, speaking of cover-up, one thing, I'm so happy that you wrote about him in your book, because very few people have ever mentioned the role that Bill Moyer played in the cover-up of the assassination. He puts himself out there now, I don't know, maybe because he's old and he's afraid he's going to die and he wants to look good to God as like a person that cares about issues. But Bill Moyer was a big player in this too.
Yeah, Moyers goes to the Secret Service, and I remember Moyers is an ordained Episcopal minister, and he has a theological degree.
Mm-hmm.
And he says to the Secret Service, the president wants this goddamn bubble top off now.
Mm.
Well, those don't sound to me like the words of Bill Moyers. Those sound to me like the words of his boss, who's a vice presidential aide, Lyndon Johnson. We know that two of Kennedy's aides, Ken O'Donnell and Jerry Bruno, Warren Commission that JFK never ordered the bubble top removed.
Mm-hmm.
So Moyers has refused to be interviewed about this. He's refused to even interview with Robert Caro, who wrote a great but very flawed four-volume biography. It's interesting that some years ago, the History Channel bought a television show that was produced in Britain called The Men Who Killed Kennedy.
Mm-hmm.
It had a 90-minute show that contains much of the information we just talked about.
Right.
Wallace, the six witnesses, and so on. Moyers and Jack Valenti, both former aides to LBJ and Lady Bird, who's then still living, mount this enormous effort to block the History Channel from running this TV program. Again, Nazi-like censorship. Instead of letting it run and let people decide for themselves,
mm-hmm.
they move heaven and earth, and sadly the History Channel blinks.
Right.
They don't run the story.
Well, you know, a few years ago I interviewed Barr McClellan on his book on on LBJ, which I was happy to see his name and his book quoted in your book too. And he told me that story because his segment was also cut from that film.
Yes.
But he was nice enough. He says, Maria, I have it on, in those years, VHS. He says, I can send it to you, which he did. At least I got to see it.
Yeah, you can see it on YouTube today. It's extremely compelling.
Mm-hmm.
The interview with Barr McClellan is really kind of the highlight of it. He's
right.
Very, very effective in what he saw and what he knew. I have sought to build on the scholarship of others in my book, but in a way, I think we have to start from the beginning and describe what was happening in November of 1963, because in any murder investigation, you have to look at motive,
mm-hmm.
means, and opportunity. And 1963, Lyndon Johnson has a particular motive. He knows that JFK plans to dump him from the ticket. Indeed, John Kennedy tells Evelyn Lincoln, his personal secretary, that on the eve of leaving for Texas, he tells her, LBJ will not be on the ticket. He says, quote, I don't know who it will be, but it won't be Lyndon, quote.
All right. And didn't Bobby have quite a case against Lyndon Johnson, too?
Yes, Bobby Kennedy was furious about the fact that in 1960, in essence, Johnson blackmailed his way onto the ticket.
Mm-hmm.
The decision had been made. JFK had already asked Senator Stuart Symington from Missouri to be his running mate. Symington had accepted. Symington had was drafting his acceptance speech when LBJ and House Speaker Sam Rayburn, also a Texan, went to Kennedy's hotel room late at night, and they had with them a file on Kennedy's sex life, which had been provided by J. Edgar Hoover, the head of the FBI. Hoover is a close political ally of Johnson's.
Mm-hmm.
Hoover's budget at the FBI has tripled between 1951 and 1963, thanks to the good graces of Senate Majority Leader and Appropriations Committee member Lyndon Johnson.
Mm-hmm.
Johnson and Hoover are next-door neighbors in Northwest Washington, but more importantly, the Kennedys plan to cashier Hoover when he hits mandatory retirement age in 1964. And Hoover knows this. He is openly contemptuous of the Kennedys and they of him. So his motive is clear. Anyway, Johnson goes to Kennedy with this dossier and says, you need Texas, you need me. If you won't put me on the ticket, I'll give this information to Dick Nixon.
Mm-hmm.
So Kennedy folds, and there's ample quotations from Kennedy aides and other insiders that he was very distraught. Bobby was furious. Labor went crazy. The African-American group within the Democratic Party went crazy.
Mm-hmm.
The liberals in the party went crazy because they all supported JFK for the nomination, and Johnson, who was a segregationist at that time,
mm-hmm.
Stood for everything they hated.
Right.
So Bobby never got over that. And in 1963, he was feeding information to the U.S. Senate that was probing Johnson in what was known then as the Bobby Baker scandal. Baker was the secretary of the U.S. Senate. He was Johnson's right-hand man. That's Johnson's description, not mine. My strong right arm, that's what he called him. And Baker is jammed up because he's been a bag man for Lyndon Johnson. He's taken bribes on behalf of Lyndon Johnson, millions of dollars worth of bribes. Additionally, Apparently, Kennedy is feeding the Time Life about a Justice Department investigation into Lyndon Johnson and Billy Sol Estes.
Right.
Sol Estes is a flamboyant Texas wheeler dealer, con man, and he and Johnson have made millions in fraudulent federal contracts that Johnson has delivered and Estes has looted.
Right.
So Johnson knows that Time Life has a hit team on the ground, a SWAT team of 9 investigative reporters digging into Lyndon Johnson. And what they learn is that in 1963, LBJ, who's been on the public payroll his entire life, is worth $25 million. That's $150 million today or more.
Well, that's an awful lot of public salary.
And their expose issue, their cover issue, is scheduled for December 1st. So the jig is up for LBJ December 1st. He's not just looking at political defeat and humiliation.
Right.
He's looking at federal prosecution and jail. That's
right.
His motivation.
Well, that was some motivation, you know, and that's why I like your chapter, you know, who benefits, cui bono. And people have to always think about that. You know, I don't know how old you were at the time, Roger, but I was like 12 and a half when Kennedy was killed. And I remember, you know, at 12 years old, looking at Johnson when he was getting sworn in and saying in my little girl's head, you know, we're looking at, you know, a long time ago, saying in my head, he did it. You know, there was just something generating out of him and his wife, you know, that just in my stomach, it was like he did it.
Yeah, within seconds of being sworn, first of all, the entire swearing-in is superfluous.
Right.
Under our American Constitution, the vice president automatically becomes president legally upon the death of the president. Mm-hmm. So the entire swearing-in was symbolic. He insisted Jackie Kennedy be there, despite the fact that she's soaked in blood and she's shell-shocked. You can see that in the picture. And as soon as he's sworn in, Lady Bird breaks out into a broad smile. And LBJ turns around and winks.
Yeah, really sick.
Congressman Albert Watson, who was a crony of his from Texas. It is interesting that when Johnson was selected for vice president, a reporter asked him the next morning, why would you give up one of the most powerful jobs in Washington, Senate Majority Leader, to be vice president, a job
right.
with no power at all?
Uh-huh.
And he said, well, I checked the odds, and there's a 1 in 4 chance that as vice president and I would accede to the presidency if the president dies. Maybe this is why Bobby Baker, his right-hand man, says in 1961 at the Kennedy inauguration, John Kennedy will not fill out his term, and he will die a violent death.
Right. Kind of reminds you of George Herbert Walker Bush when Reagan was shot.
Yeah. Yes.
You know, reading Russ Baker's book on the Bushes, it was obvious that he wanted to be president desperately. You know, these people are all pretty sick.
Yeah, that's a fine book, and I was able to learn a lot of things about George H.W. Bush and his activities on November 22nd, 1963,
But he doesn't remember where he was. Roger, he says he doesn't remember where he was. Is he kidding me? Do you know what I mean?
There's no adult who was alive in 1963, and most children of, you know, the age of comprehension know they were. I was 11 years old, and I know exactly where I was.
Right. You probably can remember the day. Right.
You know, everybody knows.
Right.
That's an absurdity. And, of course, we later find out that he's in Dallas, and then Tyler, Texas, then back in Dallas, all on the 22nd. And there's a whole series of dissembling there that just is illogical, makes no sense.
Mm-hmm. I know.
I don't want to get off on...
No, don't go. I have too many questions, so let's keep going. I was super surprised. You know, it takes a lot to surprise me after all these books. And just for an aside for my listeners, I have interviews. They're still there with Russ Baker, with Barr McClellan. They're here in the archives. Just put their name, pop their name in, or just put in the search bar, assassinations. You'll get them all. I was very surprised in your book to read that Bill O'Reilly, another person who I find totally repulsive, was also in Dallas that day. And why did he lie about being not? He said he was in Florida instead. Why would he do that?
Yeah, actually, I think the story is that he there was a fellow named George DeMorenshield. DeMorenshield is a wealthy business consultant, who has been on the periphery of the oil and energy business, and I believe he is Oswald's Dallas-based CIA handler. DeMorin Shield and his wife really kind of adopt the Oswalds, but the social gap between them is enormous. But it is DeMorin Shield who gets Oswald his first job in Dallas, not the job in the Texas School Book Depository building, but a job in a mapping company, which has a federal contract, and a security clearance. Very odd place to put a guy who's supposed to be a communist, by the way.
Right.
And DeMorin Shield, was a friend of George Bush's, and DeMorin Shield, had moved to Palm Beach, and while in Palm Beach, he was contacted by the House Select Committee on Assassinations for testimony. And he took a shotgun, put it in his mouth, and committed suicide, one bullet. O'Reilly claimed that he was on the doorstep in Palm Beach when this happened, seeking to interview DeMorin Shield. Yet there is footage of O'Reilly on television in Dallas at the exact same time. This is 1978. So it's hard to understand how Bill O'Reilly, as great as he is, can be in two places at the same time.
Well, Oswald was in two places at the same time. Maybe they're just, maybe they're superstars from another galaxy.
I don't know. I think in this case, I take my honest guess on this. I don't think Bill O'Reilly wrote his book. I'm not even sure he's read his book. I think Martin Dugard has written these books, his co-writer.
Right.
I say that because even when O'Reilly is interviewed, he seems very vague on the details in his own book.
Well, I think a lot of people do that. You and I had a brief discussion before the show today where I always like to let my guests know, listen, I read your whole book, so this should be a pretty interesting interview. And how shocking that is to most of my guests. And I think it's a disservice to anybody when someone doesn't even know their own book. Okay. Let alone, how could you possibly, interview somebody? But there are a lot of ghostwriters out there.
Well, it is refreshing to be interviewed by someone who's actually read the material we're going to discuss. I cannot tell you how much I appreciate that. In this case, I'm just going to assume that Bill didn't carefully edit his own book, because no man can be in two places at the same time.
Right. Well, Roger, you and I are very close to the same age. I'm sure you saw that movie years ago. Burt Lancaster was in it. It was called Executive Action.
Yep, terrific movie.
Now, wouldn't you say that that movie is pretty accurate to what probably happened that day?
Yeah, my memory of it is somewhat vague, other than the fact that I remember enjoying it.
But you can rent it, folks. Rent the movie.
For
a while, they stopped showing that movie. They wouldn't allow it to be shown. And I think one of Sinatra's movies too, where he played the Manchurian Candidate, was also taken out.
Barred as well. That's also a terrific movie. Look, I find it interesting that the Oliver Stone movie JFK, which I think is at least partially correct. I mean, it's a great piece of movie making. Don't get me wrong. And I think you got the basic plot line correct, because Johnson doesn't act alone here. He does act in concert with the CIA.
Mm-hmm.
He does act in concert with organized crime. He does act in concert with Big Texas Oil. But my case to you is he has a unique relationship with each of them.
Yeah, and the cops in Texas.
He's the appropriator for the CIA. He's tucked their black box secret budgets into the aerospace budget whilst he's Senate Majority Leader. He's the guy who delivers the cash. CIA can't operate without hundreds of millions of dollars appropriated by Lyndon Johnson.
Well, who else could have ordered the Secret Service stand down that day? Or taken the bubble top off the car? And oh my God, I never read before, the seating arrangements in the limo, how Johnson wanted Connolly in the car with him, and the fact that Johnson ducked before the shot was fired. I mean, I never read that anywhere else before.
Yeah, it's very interesting that the very first man that Johnson sees when he returns to Washington, the guy who bounds up the steps to Air Force One and gets a big bear hug from LBJ, is Secret Service Director James Rowley. And when I researched it, I find that Rowley got his first job in 1938 from Johnson. So I think that explains the various violations of Secret Service procedure on the ground in Dallas. There's supposed to be 6 motorcycle cops. There's 2. There's supposed to be buildings on both sides of Dealey Plaza. They're supposed to be empty and sealed. They're not.
Right, all windows
open. There's supposed to be 2 agents on the rear bumper. They're ordered off. There's supposed to be 2 agents walking abreast the rear axle when it drops below 50 miles an hour. There isn't. You're not supposed to take the 120-degree turn into Dealey Plaza because it slows the car to a near stop, making the chief executive vulnerable. They do. So there's too many, quote-unquote, errors by the Secret Service, errors that are not duplicated on the 21st in Houston and San Antonio. It's
right.
Also interesting to me that Lyndon Johnson and John Connolly want to micromanage every nanosecond of the stop in Dallas, but they have no interest whatsoever in the logistics in San Antonio and Houston the day before.
Well, wasn't it Johnson and Connolly that decided the route for the motorcade? Isn't that unusual?
Yes. John Connolly, who was Johnson's chief of staff and his campaign manager in 1948, essentially insisted on the drive through Dealey Plaza. When Jerry Bruno, who was the chief advance man for the for Kennedy, objected, finally pitched a fit. He said, this is a direct quote, "You tell the president he does it our way, or the invitation is rescinded, and we don't want him."
Crazy.
Now, I've done 13 presidential trips for Ronald Reagan, coordinating between the Secret Service, the White House staff, and the local politicians, and I can tell you, governors don't talk to presidents that way. Never. And no one talks to the presidential staff that way. We know from Senator George Smathers' memoirs that it was Johnson who insisted on the trip to Dallas. JFK tells Smathers that Johnson's put together this trip to Texas, and I'm dreading it. I really don't want to go.
Mm-hmm.
We also know, interestingly enough, and this is not in my book because I learned it afterwards, but it will be in the further editions, Kennedy tells Smathers, according to Smathers' memoirs, that Johnson even wanted Jackie Kennedy to ride with in his car.
Hmm. I didn't know that, but I didn't know, also never read that he tried to duck in the back seat of the limo he was in before the shot ran out.
When his car makes the turn into Dealey Plaza, but before the first shot is fired, he hits the deck. He's on the floor.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, and he's clutching a walkie-talkie. What's he listening for? Later on, he pressures Rufus Youngblood, a Secret Service agent, to testify that he pushed Johnson to the floor when he heard the first bullet. After Johnson's death, Youngblood admitted that wasn't true, that he said that because Johnson told him to, and he was the president of the United States, so he did what he was told. But it's a lie. I think that's the greatest piece of evidence. Now, how do we know that's true? Well, we know it two ways. One, it's in the memoirs of Senator Ralph Yarborough, who was in the car. But secondarily, there's a photograph actually taken where we can see Lady Bird smiling and waving. We can see Yarborough smiling and waving. There's no Johnson. He's missing. Why? He's on the floorboard.
Mm-hmm.
And we know the exact time that photograph was taken, and we know the exact time of the first shot. So it is the greatest single piece of evidence, other than the fingerprint for Mack Wallace, that ties Johnson to this crime.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, who benefited more than he did? Let's face it, he became president instead of going to jail.
He had a choice. He could either become president or go to a federal penitentiary. Mm-hmm. There's a Latin axiom that says, cui protis seclus est fict. The person who derived the greatest benefit from the crime is the person who committed it.
Oh, I always agree with that on so many levels. I totally agree with that. You know, a lot of people made Johnson a hero when it came to civil rights. But then when I'm reading your book and some of the nasty things that he had to say, you know, like the Negroes are getting uppity and I'll have those niggers vote Democrat the next 200 years, was pretty shocking to me because I bought the story too.
Yeah, it's important to recognize that Johnson is a virulent anti-segregationist his entire career. He's the head of the Southern Bloc in the Senate. He blocks every major piece of civil rights legislation or anti-lynching legislation through the 40s and 50s. In both the House and the Senate, he's a segregationist. The only reason he embraces civil rights is to blunt a challenge from Robert Kennedy in 1964 from the left. Mm-hmm. There's actually a phone call in which he says, Bobby, going to stir up the Negroes and the Catholics to come after me. So even when Johnson does the right thing, he does it for the wrong reasons.
Right.
Whether principle or human dignity or all the right reasons why we should have civil rights for all Americans regardless of their color, it's because it's a political maneuver.
Right. Well, what did you think about, there's so much here, what did you think about the fact that Johnson wouldn't leave Dallas without Kennedy's body and immediately had that limo, the evidence, you know, cleaned and scraped?
Yeah, the chain of evidence, which is basic to any criminal investigation, is repeatedly violated by the Dallas Police Department in their so-called investigation of the murder. The Secret Service agents removed JFK's body for an autopsy in Washington when, by law, the autopsy should have been conducted in Texas. I think that's the key point here, which is mm-hmm. in 1963, murder in Texas is a state crime. It's not a federal crime. There is no federal crime against murder of a president or murder, period.
Right.
That means the investigation lies in the hands of the Dallas Police Department, the Dallas County Sheriff's Office, and the Dallas County District Attorney. In other words, Lyndon Johnson. Those are his fiefdoms. He controls the police. He controls the Sheriff's Office. He controls the DA. Indeed, Johnson aide Cliff Carter, was his hatchet man and I think was deeply involved in the planning of the assassination, calls a district attorney from Air Force One just before they take off for Washington and says, President Johnson says you are to charge Oswald with murder only. No additional charge and specifically no conspiracy charge.
Mm-hmm.
There is a federal law against conspiracy.
Right.
So I, again, further evidence that Johnson is trying to manipulate the investigation from the get-go.
Right, but then, you know, a couple of days later, doesn't, you know, when they're talking to Johnson, doesn't he say, you know, I'm president, I don't have time to partake, you know, worry about every killing in this country, even if it is a president that was killed.
Yeah, and he says, we don't need to be investigating every little scrape.
Right, scrape.
Every little scrape out there, he says to Jerry Hoover.
But
he wants to minimize the investigation. He's not interested in any scrutiny whatsoever.
Absolutely. Now, wasn't it Nixon that also said that Bobby Kennedy would be assassinated?
Nixon is in his hotel room when Bobby Kennedy announces that he's going to run. Remember, Kennedy only jumps into the race after Eugene McCarthy, the senator from Minnesota, nicks Johnson in the New Hampshire primary.
Mm-hmm.
So the anti-war left is trying to get Bobby to run. Bobby won't run because he's afraid he'll lose. And he decides he's going to bide his time and wait till 1972. And then McCarthy moves ahead on an anti-war platform. He runs better than expected in New Hampshire, and Bobby jumps into the race.
Mm-hmm.
So Nixon is in a hotel room in Seattle where he's campaigning for the Republican nomination. This is in John Ehrlichman's memoirs. And he is watching Kennedy on TV announce his candidacy. Nixon switches the set off, and he says, we have just seen some horrible forces unleashed. Something terrible will come of this.
Yeah, and then we saw the terrible. It was called the presidency of Johnson. Now, you know, everybody talks about, you know, and I've talked about this a lot with Jim Fetzer, you know, first they assassinate the president, then they assassinated his character. But a lot of people don't realize that Lyndon Johnson was a big-time whore master, too. Okay. Even, you know, some of the things you wrote in your book, like I said, as a woman and a mother, it was hard for me to read just how disgusting this man was.
And he fathers at least three illegitimate children that we know of. Jack Valenti is the beard, who is married to Mary Wiley Valenti, who's one of Johnson's mistresses. Their daughter, whose last name is Valente, is Lyndon Johnson's daughter. There's actually a tape of LBJ talking to Valente on the phone. He says, Jack, what are you going to do tonight? He says, I'm going to go home and play with my daughter. And Johnson says, your daughter.
Hmm.
There are no rules for Johnson. He has an unlimited appetite for cigarettes, alcohol, and women. I mean, this is a guy who named his penis Jumbo.
Yeah.
And he had this tremendous tendency to expose himself in public because he could. I mean, he's absolutely a repugnant character. I mean, it's not just that he's dishonest and evil. He is corrupt, and he's perverted. I mean, and there are no rules for him. He has a buzzer because Lady Bird evidently disturbed him one day and found him on the couch with one of the secretaries. He has a buzzer set in his office so Secret Service can let him know in advance if Lady Bird is headed towards the Oval Office. It's called the Lady Bird buzzer. He is every bit as promiscuous as John F. Kennedy, although I don't think his taste is as good.
No, and he certainly wasn't as good looking either. But the thought even that he would walk around naked, even in front of his daughters, was really sick. Okay.
Yeah, one Secret Service agent said that on Air Force One, as soon as they took off, he was traveling with just the family, he would strip down completely naked and walk around the plane simply because he could. There's another instance where he gets into an argument with a reporter about why we're in Vietnam. He pulls out his manhood and says, "This is why."
Right, you know,
ours is bigger than theirs.
Ugh.
So he's sick. He is a very, very sick individual.
And this was president with his fake Gulf of Tonkin stories and so much crap. You know, you look at how many lives were lost because we had a maniac like that in office. I mean, Roger,
Lady Bird, and Lady Bird has enormous holdings in Brown and Root, now known as Halliburton.
Right.
And she has enormous holdings in Bell Helicopter, and she has enormous stock holdings in General Dynamics. So Johnson himself was profiteering off the war. He was making millions in stock off the war. There's actually a story in my book about him being on the phone with his stockbroker minutes after Kennedy is dead, rearranging his stock portfolio so that he can benefit.
I know.
I mean, this is a very sick individual.
Very, very sick. Roger, we only have a few minutes left, but your book also covers, and I'm so glad, the assassination of Bobby Kennedy. And, you know, the question is, did Johnson have anything to do with the death of Martin Luther King and Bobby Kennedy?
I think there's some evidence that he did. Here's why. In the case of Dr. King, there's an FBI wiretap on King because Hoover is convinced that he is a communist. It's important to remember that King had emerged as a major critic of the war in Vietnam. So he is public enemy number one to Johnson. He's picked up on a wiretap telling an associate that he is going to endorse Bob Kennedy in the primaries for president, and only days later, King is assassinated. We also know that Robert Kennedy, and this was told to me by Frank Mankiewicz, who is a friend of mine of 35 years and Kennedy's press secretary, that Bobby Kennedy surprised everybody in student forum while campaigning in Northern California when he said that he was going to reopen the investigation into his brother's death.
Mm-hmm.
That had to send chills up the spine of Lyndon Johnson, the Central Intelligence Agency, organized crime, and other Johnson associates who were involved in the assassination. So, yes, I'm convinced that the same people who killed John Kennedy killed both Dr. King and Robert Kennedy. And their motive is clear. Robert Kennedy ever became president, he would reopen the investigation and the perps would have been found.
Right. Well, Roger, I have to tell you, your book just is smoking hot. Everybody really needs to read it. The Man Who Killed Kennedy, The Case Against LBJ. There's so much facts and figures in here that you're never going to want to let that book out of your library, because that's how I feel about it, Roger. So I'm so grateful that you had time to join me today.
Yes, I appreciate it. You can actually get the book by going to lbjkilledjfk.com or, of course, Barnes & Noble or Amazon, The Man Who Killed Kennedy, The Case Against LBJ.
Right.
Very exciting, and I hope you enjoy reading it as much as I enjoyed writing it.
Well, thank you so much. Take good care now.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening and supporting The Maria Show. Tell others what you learned today. Knowledge becomes wisdom only when it's shared. Encourage others to subscribe today. www.maria.net. Often imitated, never duplicated. A world of information all in one place. www.maria.net. Always ahead of the curve. Always on your side. Get active or get radioactive. Subscribe today.